Welcome back to the Kennedy Dynasty Podcast. I'm your host, Allison, and joined again for part two of this fascinating Mississippi Delta visit episode is my friend joining me, Ryan Pryor. Thanks again
Hi.
For joining me.
Hi, how are you?
I realized last episode we didn't tell people what we were drinking. We got to tell
them. Oh, so hey, I've got a little red. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, my bad. No, you go first. You're the guest.
I have it's a Thursday night, so it's casual. So a little bit of red wine. Mm-hmm. After almost being done with a long week, after I'm done with this, I'm going to have to go make a quiz.
Let me make it.
Have you read chapter 1.3 of the U.S. government textbook on OpenStax?
You bet I have.
I doubt it. So no,
I have not.
But I will tell you about it.
I probably didn't even read it when I was in that class. I probably skimmed it and then
I doubt you did.
During the test.
I doubt you did. I doubt you did.
I am drinking a whiskey sour made with Jack Daniels and a nice little cherry in it. So,
cheers. I love a good cherry.
Let me get a cheers and let's take a pic for the gram. How about it? Ready? Cheers. Oh, you look so distinguished.
I am distinguished.
Okay. All right. I'm going to leave
it
in.
Yeah, leave it in. Why not? Let's get into it. Let's dig in, right?
Let's dig in.
So, to recap, Robert Kennedy, Joseph S. Clark, traveling along Route 61 to visit locations that Marion Wright had suggested for them, the first being Cleveland, Mississippi. And they arrive at a shotgun house. Now, you don't know what a shotgun house is, do you, Allison? Mm. Or do you?
I totally do. I just want to quiz you.
Sure.
Make sure you know what it is.
That's fine. A shotgun house is named not because it looks anything like a shotgun, but because it is a specific type of house that is basically one long room. Mm-hmm. You open the door, and the reason it's called a shotgun house is because you can put a shotgun barrel in the front door and shoot it, and all of your pellets will go out the back door. Okay?
Ding, ding, ding. You got it right. Yay.
There you go. Thanks. I appreciate it. I tried my best.
No, honestly, didn't know what that was, obviously. And that is
shotgun
really
terrifying. Shotgun shacks, as they are called, were very common and still are very common in Mississippi Delta and places like Memphis. And once you know what a shotgun shack looks like, you'll start seeing them everywhere. Mm-hmm. They are houses where the minute you walk in, it's one big room. There might be another room for a bedroom, or the one big room in the front might be the bedroom and the living room. And there might be, and the kitchen is in the back.
Interesting.
Okay. They're tiny. Mm-hmm. And Robert Kennedy and Joseph S. Clark arrive at the shotgun shack in Cleveland, Mississippi, where 15 people are living in the same house. God. There's holes in the floors and the ceilings. The walls have no insulation. There's no electricity. There's no running water.
Oh, were there babies living in the house? Oh, it's so pitiful.
Whenever Robert Kennedy looks into the refrigerator, he finds one half-empty jar of peanut butter. And when he talks to a young, he begins talking to children, trying to figure out what they're like. What have you been eating? What have you been eating? Some of them say nothing. Some of them may have eaten, like syrup or sugar or raw sugar cane or just whatever they could find out in this, we're talking like field greens and things like that. It is a shocking revelation to Robert Kennedy. To see this kind of poverty, to see this kind of degradation. Goes to another home. There's no toilet. They have seven people living in the house. There's no toilet. And there are roaches all over the floor, children playing with things on the ground. And he notices one young child whose stomach is distended, which we know what distended means. It's the things mm-hmm. that you see whenever you watch videos about, the Congo, right? In Africa, the things that we think don't happen here. And he says, I did not know this kind of thing existed. How can this country allow such a thing to happen? He kind of remarks and talks about how much money the United States spent every year on the things that it spent on, right? I mean, Robert F. Kennedy was a senator, so he was, involved heavily in the, budget and things like that for the Senate and for the United States. He is just flabbergasted. He keeps driving through, and he's getting heckled, by the way. He keeps getting heckled by Mississippi senators saying, you're not seeing things. You've been told things. You've been told lies. And Kennedy and Clark kind of respond with, I don't think there's a lie big enough to, they don't say this exactly, but basically, I don't think there's a lie big enough that can cover up what we're seeing. Mm-hmm. We've seen it. We've seen enough. On the way back, they're headed towards Clarksdale, Mississippi, from Cleveland. And he ended up stopping at a small town called Mound Bayou. Now, listen, guys, unless you live in the South, you don't understand that they're just little towns that have names like Mound Bayou and Bucksnort, right? Mm-hmm. These are not, whenever we say towns, Allison knows this, we're not talking about municipalities with 500, 600, 700, even 1,000 people. We're talking about little tiny one light places that might have a gas station or might have a
convenience
store.
They have like a McDonald's
store.
Gas station and lots of hay bales.
Maybe,
basically.
Maybe. They might not even have that. Like 100 people.
The nearest Walmart is like 40 minutes away.
At the bigger town, which is 5,000 people. He walks up to the to the house of a man. No electricity again, no running water, no toilet. And the man's name was actually, was Andrew Jackson. They exchange pleasantries and things like that. But this is just, again, he's stopping along. And this is to say that he is stopping at just random houses. He's not letting someone guide him through. He doesn't want somebody to show him what he wants to see. He wants to see it for himself. So he's just stopping at random people's houses. And of course, they recognize him. They know mm-hmm. They knew his brother. By the time he gets to Clarksdale, there is a crowd of people, a couple thousand people, mostly black people and school children who are waiting there to talk to him. He gets up on tops of cars and he says, guys, I want to stay here. I want to know more, but I gotta get going. I've got a plane to catch in Memphis, but we're gonna fix this. He said, what I have seen today is ridiculous. Not ridiculous, but it's crazy. And the problems of poverty in the United States, the problems of poverty that I see here are not just your problems, they're the problems of the American people. Mm-hmm. And he flies back to Washington. And he knows that it is a deeply moving experience for him. Because when he gets back, he is downtrodden. He has several instances where he lashes out at his daughters and his children and just says things like, you have no idea how well you live. You have no idea the kind of things that I saw, the kind of people telling his children and his wife that, you know, I saw children with their tummies who were sticking out, who were emaciated and dying. We all have these experiences in our life, I think, where we witness something that tears us to our very core and something that maybe we didn't know existed. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'd rather not know. And for a man who grew up in privilege like Robert Kennedy did, for a man who grew up in a compound, you know, with his millionaire father and his, you know, his politician brothers, can you imagine the kind of emotion that was going through his brain?
Yeah. You know, I'm actually, his daughter talked about that in the Ethel documentary made by Rory Kennedy, which is their youngest daughter. And his daughter Kathleen talked about his when he came back from the visit to the Delta. So I'm going to insert a clip of what she says about it right here.
When Daddy went down to the Delta, he was just so riveted by the experience.
You have lunch. You haven't had lunch yet?
He described how the children had distended stomachs and had sores all over their tummy because they didn't have enough to eat.
He arrived home just as we were having dinner, clearly moved and emotionally exhausted, I say, from seeing such dire poverty.
I remember it was a lovely evening, and the table in our dining room was set. And as you know, we had a really nice dining room with chandeliers and the crystal on the glasses and a cook to cook dinner and somebody to serve it. And Daddy walked in. I was just there. And he said, I've just been to Mississippi and I've seen a family live in a room the size of this dining room. Do you know how lucky you are? And he was shaking. Do you know how lucky you are? You have to do something for our country. You have to give back.
So Kennedy and Clark send a report to Johnson and say basically like, hey, we need to provide relief for these people. And this is a knock on Johnson. Basically, Johnson, he didn't want to appear to be a socialist or a communist or whatever. He doesn't do anything about it. He was very uneasy about extending social welfare programs, like the idea of social welfare programs. Like he was supportive of social welfare in general, but he didn't want to overextend and be called a communist, right? Because at this time, mm-hmm. we know in the 1950s and 60s, you know, if you were accused of being a communist, you know, politically, it was terrible.
He also hated Bobby and like disagreed with him on nearly everything.
Yeah. 100%.
And wanted to disagree with him on nearly everything.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Absolutely. Basically, there is then, however, a set of hearings that were created to basically create media coverage and to create pressure on the Johnson administration and the senators from Mississippi, Stennis and James Eastland, to do something. Kennedy called all of these doctors and these nutrition experts and things like that and called and to come forward and talk about the sheer desperation, the starvation that was going on. And he expresses how he's mad at Johnson. He says Johnson is not doing his job. Lyndon B. Johnson is not fighting this war, is not doing what he needs to be doing for the American people.
Was this before, you might not know the exact date of this, but was this before he spoke out against Johnson? I talked about it in an episode about the Vietnam War and his stances on the war, or was this after?
I'm not entirely sure.
It this probably would have been before, because that probably would have been 68.
Yeah, well, this was in July of 1967.
Yeah, so I'm surprised, actually, Bobby was kind of trying to stay on his good side for if he ran, you know, a presidential campaign and whatnot, and didn't really want to speak out against him. So I'm surprised. It must have touched Bobby pretty deeply to speak out against Johnson in that way before he spoke out before the Vietnam War, is what I was saying. So, or before his stance of the Vietnam War. So
this actually does lead to a lot of, like, but this thing that the media coverage that he brings, it actually does a whole lot of good. He's able to amend the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964. The media coverage and the public backlash against this is immediate and swift. You would be surprised. When people are put face-to-face with suffering, and I think that I'm going to make a little bit of a connection, and I'm going to say some things that it's very similar in regard to what we saw last summer with the recordings of the murder of George Floyd. I think the reason that you finally saw a dam burst and people come out and just be really sort of like their minds were changed, or maybe they were enough for them to get out, was because they saw it.
Couldn't look away from it or ignore
they
it.
You couldn't look. I don't know if you've watched the whole thing. I watched the whole thing and it made me deeply, it made me deeply sad.
Oh, yeah.
It deeply affected me and changed my mind on a lot of things.
Yeah,
it made me think about things in a different way. And so this exact same effect happens to the people of the United States. The idea of Americans starving to people who are patriotic was, I think it just made them sick.
I'm actually really glad you made that connection, because I noticed when I was reading a little bit about the visit that someone who was there made the observation of Bobby that he was kind of shy, reserved to himself. He wasn't this like... He didn't put himself or make himself seem like this really boisterous politician. He really like reserved himself to when he was on his visit to the Delta, and he really listened. It was very noted that he asked a lot of questions. He didn't give advice. He didn't do anything stupid like that. He literally sat back and listened. And I think that was such a cry for help from the entire Black Lives Matter movement, continues to be, and from everything that did happen last summer. Just freaking listen to us, please.
Yeah.
And I feel like Bobby really personified that, even in 67, in a different way and with a different group. But he did what you have to do when you want to fight with somebody, or you want to help somebody, or you want to be an ally, is he listened. And I just think that that's really something to look up to.
I agree. And because of this, one of the most direct results was the Poor People's March on Washington, led by Martin Luther King Jr. The Poor People's March on Washington was a direct result of the media coverage of these hearings. But I think the legacy of it is even better, is that by the 1970s, by 1975, the United States had actually, through programs, through nutrition programs, through food insecurity programs, through deliberate action, had... And most historians agree on this, virtually eliminated hunger in America. To this day, we actually have virtually eliminated hunger in America.
It's incredible.
We have, in some ways, the opposite problem now, right? You go to these places in the Delta, you go to these places in poor areas, and it's not so much that people are starving, it's that they're not eating the right, they don't have access to the right kinds of food. And so they're developing diseases of malnutrition in the opposite way. And that's another story for another day. And
I would love for Caroline to talk about that kind of stuff too.
Absolutely would. And I think that, again, organizations like the one Caroline works for, you know, are direct results of this kind of necessity. of the kind of things that still go on. And by the way, guys, just because, I mean, they, so CBS aired a documentary right after this called Hunger in America, really, which brought a lot of focus to this. But to this day, there are still huge problems of you know, obesity now. And you can eat as much as you want to, but if the food you're eating doesn't have real nutritional value, you can have the same exact problems as if your belly is, you know, distended and you are emaciated as you do whenever you eat too much of processed, highly processed, sugar-filled food. And so in one way, one problem was replaced for another. But the fact that we have, I think the United States has eliminated hunger largely, and because of the actions of Robert Kennedy 50 years ago. And I think that's an admirable thing. That's an incredible thing.
And it's crazy how glazed over this is in general, or in the Kennedy legacy as a whole. I mean, you hear tidbits about this visit, and you hear little bits about Bobby fighting for this. But, I mean, good Lord, what a feat that this man literally put boots to the ground. And that's incredible, you know?
Well, and I think it should be taken as an example to more politicians. And the fact of the matter is that, like, if you're a politician, even, no matter, I don't care where you're from, but especially, and this is, by the way, I'm a fairly liberal person, but one of the things that I cannot stand, I'm a liberal person from a rural area. I wouldn't call myself a Democrat. I wouldn't call myself not a progressive. I call myself a progressive, but I wouldn't call myself a far left. I'm really more middle ground. But I'm from rural America, and I love rural America. I also hate rural America, but I'm allowed to because that's where I'm from, and I'm allowed to say that I love it and I hate it for almost sometimes the same reasons. And what I will tell you is that one of the things that I think we could do with more of is politicians who grew up in cities coming out to rural America, to the countryside, and seeing how people actually live their lives. And the same thing goes for, you know, politicians who grew up in the suburbs and the countryside, going into cities and seeing how people actually live. I think one of the biggest issues that we're facing today is a lack of awareness about how other people live. And so what do? We dehumanize them. If you don't know how somebody else has lived, and you equate people down to the country music in their boots and racism, and you quote unquote, and you just say that's who they are, it becomes a whole lot easier to hate them. And it becomes a whole lot easier to be mean to them. And it becomes a whole lot easier to say, I don't care about their feelings or their thoughts. Robert Kennedy went down to the Delta and saw what was happening firsthand. And so, yeah, I think this is an example, something that we need to take into the 21st century, into the 2020s. Politicians need to be doing this more. And hello, listeners of Kennedy Dynasty. If you're politically minded people, if you're people who really like believe in like systems of government, and since you're Kennedy fans, I think you probably do, get out of where you're from and go to places that you're not from. And I'm not talking about tourism. I'm not talking about like if you're from New York City going down to New Orleans, right? That's the South, but that's not what we're talking about. I'm saying go take a tour of the little small towns and the tiny places. You're not going to get run out with pitchforks. And the same thing. If you're from the little tiny places and pitchforks, get out of where you're from and go see the other parts of the world.
It's just so hard. Humanistically for us to separate ourselves from what we see day to day and have empathy for people in other regions or in other situations or other places. But honestly, at the end of the day, people are people. I mean, you have to put yourself in other people's shoes and think, what if that was my grandma or my baby or my whatever? Yeah. Like, it's just wild to me the amount of people that don't put themselves in other people's shoes. And I'm even at fault for it sometimes as well, because it's natural to be that way and to look out 100%. For ourselves, but we have to look out for our neighbors as well and think about other people. And like you said, go see it firsthand and have that empathy instilled in you, because you can't look it in the eye and not have it, you know?
I 100% agree. I live in a city, right? But I am from rural America, but I will offer my services if on Instagram, whatever, however you want to communicate with Kennedy Dynasty, if you're interested in taking a tour of the Delta, if you're interested in going to places like Clarksdale and Greenville, I'd be more than happy. Carolyn and I would be more than happy to give you, if you send it through Allison, and we can give you some suggestions of places to go, things you need to see, and also some of the best restaurants. I won't say them on here, because I want you to contact Allison if you really care about it and if you really want to take a trip. But I can put you onto the best restaurant that you will ever have in your entire life, and I will bet money on it. that I can tell you what the best restaurant that you will ever have is, and you will love it. And you will, and there are so many things, rich cultural things about this place that deserve to be seen. I've sent a couple people to the Delta and given them some downtown. And I'm not from the Delta, and Caroline works in the Delta, so she knows a lot more about it than I do. But what I will say is, I think it would be worth it for some of you, those of you who are interested, in, especially in Robert Kennedy's life, to go down and see some of the things that he saw. Either way, I'd be happy to give some recommendations if that's something of interest to you.
Yeah, send them to me. DM them. Well, Pryor, I'm so glad that you joined me for this. I've learned a lot, and I appreciate you bringing this to our listeners. Can't wait for the day that Caroline joins us and tells us all about her organization that she works with and all that she does.
I want to say that, you know, I think this episode was a little bit more serious than we often do.
It was. Right?
I mean, it was. And I think that's a good thing, though. I think it needs to be.
Yeah.
You can't joke about stuff like this. This is the real stuff. This is the real stuff. This is the this is the things that keep people up at night. This was a life-changing moment in Robert Kennedy's career.
His family says that everything shifted after the visit to the Delta.
Everything.
Like everything. Like
seminal moment.
How he viewed things, how he ran his campaigns, his persona. I mean, he was just a different man.
Yeah. Poverty tours became a huge part of Robert Kennedy's political stance after this. He would go to places deliberately to make sure that he was talking to people who needed the most help.
Right.
And I wish he would become president, but
me too.
C'est la vie.
Well, you guys, thank you so much for listening. Please rate it 5 stars, write us a positive written review, and I will talk to you guys next week.
Come on and vote for Kennedy. Vote for Kennedy. Keep America strong.